Tonight, Allie is our teacher.
Hello, everyone. It's me again. So, we are going to be talking about right intention. And we spoke about right view, or Peter spoke about right view last week. So today the focus is right intention, and the Pali term for right intention is Sama Sankappa. Right intention is also known as right thinking. So some of you might have heard it as right thinking, others right intention, they're both the same. So as I mentioned, last week, Peter discussed right view, and we can understand right view and right intention as being two sides of the same coin, where right view addresses the cognitive processes behind craving and clinging, and right intention addresses the affective processes. So when you think of craving, that is generally viewed as more of an affective component, so more to do with feelings, and clinging is more cognitive, so you think of the clinging mind. So right view is concerned with clinging, so more cognitive. Right intention is concerned with craving, which is affective and more feeling. Right intention, or right thinking, can also be seen as the precursor to right speech and right action, which we will be covering in the sessions to come. So it's our intention that sets the stage for the kinds of thoughts that we have, and therefore informs the things that we say and the things that we do, which kind of makes sense. So our goal is for our right intention to lead or to direct our thinking into wholesome states, which would then lead to wholesome speech, wholesome action, and then overall wholesome state. So again, right intention is the precursor to our thinking, our speech, and then our action. According to the Buddha, right intention contains three components, and these are the components that we're going to be discussing at length today. These three components are the intention of renunciation, intention of goodwill, and intention of harmlessness. And these three intentions are opposed to the three parallel kinds of wrong intention. So intention governed by ill will, or I'm sorry, intention governed by desire, intention governed by ill will, and intention governed by harmfulness. So renunciation as an intention counters the intention of desire, the intention of goodwill counters the intention of ill will, and the intention of harmlessness counters the intention of harmfulness. So again, like two sides of the same coin, you have renunciation, goodwill, and harmlessness countering desire, ill will, and harmfulness. So the Buddha also found that thoughts can be divided into two different categories. One category contains those of desire, ill will, and harmfulness, and the other category contains thoughts of renunciation, goodwill, and harmlessness, which seems, you know, very straightforward. But he basically was able to find that all thoughts can be either categorized in one of those categories or the other. And whenever he noticed thoughts of the first category, desire, ill will, or harmfulness, he recognized that those thoughts led to harm for oneself and others, it obstructed wisdom, and it led people away from the path to nirvana. But whenever thoughts arose of the second kind, as renunciation, goodwill, and harmlessness, he recognized that those thoughts were beneficial and conducive for cultivating wisdom and helped people move forward on a path towards nirvana. So I want to actually share my screen momentarily because there's an image that I think does a good job of explaining or of kind of illustrating this kind of concept. And I'm going to try and share my screen. I think I should have access. Okay. So here we are. Okay, can we all see this?
Yes.
Awesome. So this is an image. So I'm a counselor, for those of you who may not know, or I'm a counselor intern, I'm working towards licensure. And this is an image that is based off of a specific kind of therapy called acceptance and commitment therapy. And what this image demonstrates is what's called the choice point. And the premise of this kind of therapy is that we want to focus our thoughts, feelings, and behaviors to be in accordance with our values. So it's a very simple concept where at any given moment, we have a choice. We have a choice to move toward, as you can see in the green arrow, toward any thought, feeling, or behavior that is going to be in accordance with our values, or the opposite. We could be moved towards something that is going to be not in alignment with our values. And so I really like this image because I think it makes it a very, it simplifies it a lot. And I think that when I was, reflecting on right intention, I felt like this provided a really good conceptualization of how to think of right intention, where thoughts of renunciation, goodwill, and harmlessness are going to be what we want to move toward. So at any given moment, we have this choice for our thoughts to be in alignment with right intention. We also, at any given moment, have the choice to be hooked by ill will, harmfulness, and desire. So it's pretty objective when you think about it, and I'll get into a point later on that describes how, it's not about morality, but it's more so that, the green arrow, right intention, is going to lead to less suffering. But at the same time, moving away from those values and moving towards ill will, harmfulness, and desire will lead to suffering. It's not a moral thing, it's just this or that. So I wanted to share this with you because I felt like it's a good kind of illustration that I often will refer to in my own time, but just to kind of give some illustration for how to think of right intention as leading us toward less suffering, or likewise, if we don't move within right intention, it could lead us to more suffering. So any comments or questions on this before I stop sharing? No, it's okay. Okay, I will stop sharing. Okay, so as I mentioned, two different categories of thoughts, one that will lead towards less suffering, one that will lead towards more suffering. So now we're gonna break down the components of right intention a little bit further. So renunciation, the first intention, or sub-intention really, describes, in a nutshell, resisting desire, resisting craving. We abandon desire not because it is morally evil, as I had mentioned a little bit earlier, but because it is simply a root of suffering. So it's not a moral thing, it's just that it leads to more suffering. And by practicing renunciation, we work to resist one of the core roots of suffering, which is craving. So it's not that it's a bad thing, it's just that the Buddha recognized that thoughts conditioned by craving lead to suffering. Renunciation does not mean, at the same time, abandoning modern life and going to live in a monastery, abandoning all worldly possessions, although I know many of you may yearn for that, I know sometimes I do. But what really matters for renunciation is just the attitude in which we practice renunciation. So real renunciation is not a matter of compelling ourselves to give up things that we genuinely cherish. It's not about repressing desire, but it's about just changing our perspective on the things that we desire so that we're not binded to them. And there's, some of you, I'm sure, are familiar with a guy named Ram Dass, and he says something that I frequently, think about, which is that, we can have preferences, but it's just a matter of not being attached to preferences. So I can prefer to you know, have a bowl of ice cream. I think we spoke about that during the first talk, or the first talk that I gave. But I don't have to be attached to it, whether it's chocolate or vanilla. I can have a preference for chocolate, but I don't have to be attached to that preference. So it's not about making ourselves give things up, and it's not about having to repress the things that we want. We can want things. It's just a matter of not being attached to them. And at the root of it, renunciation ultimately provides the remedy to greed. So we can think of greed as excessive desire, whether it be sensual, materialistic, or possessive. We tend to experience greediness in one of those forms, and I'm sure that we can all account for the suffering that occurs from greediness in any kind. But we also can be greedy in terms of our self-image. We may very much desire and really crave to be seen as skillful, attractive, smart, or capable, whatever it is. We can be greedy in terms of desiring excessively to be seen in a certain kind of way. So we all experience desire and craving in one form of another. I know that we're not unfamiliar with that. So I want to pose a question to us all, and I want us to get us to think a little. What are the ways in which desire and greed manifest for you? I can say for myself that I certainly can be greedy in terms of self-image. You know, I often will want to be seen in a certain way. I'll want to be seen as smart, as capable. And, you know, sometimes, you know, I can be greedy with food, I'll admit. Working on that one, but you know, sometimes I'll overindulge when it comes to food, which is not the best. But I'm wanting to get a sense for how desire or greed will manifest for some of you. What do you notice yourself desiring or feeling greed over? Hi, Leslie.
Hi. Oh yeah, I've worked with this so much. This is a good question. Thank you for provoking us to think about this, because I'll just give you my worst one, and it's shoes. I've always loved clothes and dressing up, and since I was a little girl, and I just have never been able to sort of shake that desire that I've had to bedeck myself in a certain way. I don't do it, I don't think, so much for other people's interest or approval. It was like when I was a little girl, I could just dress up myself and sit in my room or read a book or something. But I think I told everybody in the teachers meeting that I'm having this little art area devised in my closet, and I'm having to get rid of a lot of clothes. And I have a whole wall of shoes. And the carpenter that was in there, he was saying, you know, you have 5 different colors of sneakers here. Why do you need 5 different colors? He's like my hired hand. He's like criticizing my in shoes. Not that I didn't know that I had 5 different colors of sneakers, but this is where my greed really shows up. And I can give you lots of other examples. Unfortunately, it's one of my largest flaws in life. But if I see one pair of shoes that I like, I have to have them in purple and in yellow and in red. And it's just like one color is not enough. And that's just sheer greed and overconsumption, and we could go on and on. So that's a good example for you, right, Allie?
Yes, thank you. I appreciate the authenticity and the honesty. I also am the same, not when it comes to shoes, but definitely when it comes to clothing. I don't know if it makes it any better that I'm greedy for secondhand clothing, but I will often go to thrift stores and just buy, you know, a bunch of used clothing that I probably don't need. Yeah, do you want to mention something else, Leslie?
No, I was just going to say, I do think that's better. At least you're keeping, you know, it's more sustainable to do that, yeah.
Thank you. I feel a little better.
I have a comment.
anybody else?
Yes, Sharon. Sharon here in the room has something.
Hi, Allie.
Yeah. Hi.
I'm curious. I'm kind of puzzled at the connection between intention and greed. To me, it's sounding like a distinction between maybe craving and greed. I mean, to me, craving and greed, I can see to get as a situational hook or whatever. I'm trying to, you know, follow your thoughts on this example. I don't know.
Yeah,
that's a great question.
So, to clarify, so the intention of renunciation is the remedy to greed.
Okay.
So right now we're just exploring greed and how it manifests for us, because the intention of renunciation is what ultimately would alleviate when we suffer from greed. Does that make a little bit more sense?
You know what? I made a mistake. It was the relationship between desire. I kind of drifted away when I was listening to what the comment that Leslie was making. Somehow desire and intention, I'm not sure. I kind of got lost now. I forgot what I was going to.
So I can clarify a little bit further. So renunciation is what helps to counter both desire and greed. And so you can see greed as a more intense manifestation of desire.
Okay.
So really, when we're focusing on renunciation, renunciation being the counter intention to desire and greed.
Now I get it. Okay. Thank you. I get it.
Yeah. Awesome.
Can I
Anybody
add something?
Else?
Yeah. Can
yeah.
I add something to that?
Please.
That might clarify things. The Pali word for desire is tanha. And it's translated as thirst, an unquenchable thirst. So in terms of shoes or clothing or prestige or whatever, no matter how often we get what we want, it's not enough.
That's good.
There it is. So sometimes we can be just like in an ongoing hamster wheel of desire, which then leads to greed.
Yeah, desire can also be the desire to avoid, you know, the aversion part, which
I think I'm getting that now. Sort of like there's never enough.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Peter. I can move on if no one else but wants to make a comment. Okay, let's keep going. So then this big question of, well, then how do we practice renunciation? And having consulted with Peter on this question earlier today, the key for practicing renunciation is really just going back to our breath. Body and breath awareness helps to reinforce renunciation. So anytime that we're caught in craving or desire, redirecting ourselves back to our breath, back to our bodies, helps to serve as a remedy for that and helps to therefore reinforce renunciation. And Peter, you gave me a really good example when it came to the analogy of you having like an itch to scratch. So when you notice that itch and you choose to not scratch that itch, you are practicing renunciation. And so it requires a certain level of mindfulness, though, to renounce that urge to scratch. And so by practicing mindfulness, by practicing tuning back into our breath, into our bodies, we are helping to cultivate renunciation. Okay, so we are going to Now move into goodwill.
Let me add one more thing to that.
Yes.
The urge to not scratch the itch also involves right effort, another part of the Eightfold Path.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's right effort is, in this context, is the noticing of an arisen urge to scratch the itch and renouncing that, to not act on it, to let the sensation be what it is. And eventually the sensation fades away, or if the sensation stays there, interest in acting on it can fade away.
Right, so then that shows how in renunciation can turn into then right effort.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Awesome. So moving into goodwill. Goodwill, as we mentioned earlier, opposes the intention of ill will, which are thoughts governed by anger and aversion. When we're in a state of ill will, it breeds resentment, it provokes retaliation, we create enemies, it poisons relationships, and it overall generates unwholesome karma. We can't repress ill will because then that leads to internalizing it and pushing it inward, where it then turns into self-contempt, depression, or tendencies for irrational outbursts of violence. The remedy then to ill will is goodwill, which can also be seen as metta or loving kindness. And metta is not just sentimental goodwill, nor should it be seen as a moral imperative or a divine command. It needs to come from deep within, characterized by an inner warmth that radiates outward rather than as a sense of obligation. And that's a really key distinction. It's not just supposed to be a sentimental cognitive process. It really needs to come from within. It shouldn't be that anyone is telling you to be loving. It needs to be a state, or it needs to come from a place of intention as opposed to obligation. And with metta, it is suggested that you first use yourself as the first object of metta, of loving kindness, because true loving kindness for others only becomes possible when one is able to feel genuine loving kindness for yourself. And so that's why often, as I'm sure many of you have practiced loving kindness meditation, often the first set of statements that you recite are to provide loving kindness for yourself. And when you're able to feel genuine metta toward yourself, the next step becomes to extend it outward toward others. We all want to be happy. We all want to be free from suffering. And as soon as we see this within ourselves, we can immediately understand that all living beings share that same basic wish, to be happy. And so when we use our own desire for happiness and then empathize with others, to recognize that others carry the same basic urge, we then can come back to our own position and extend to them that wish that they be happy and free of suffering just as we do. So I know it's not always easy to practice loving kindness, either for ourselves or for people that we may find difficult. So I'm wondering, for some of you, do you normally find it difficult to practice loving kindness for yourself or for others? Do you find it easier to practice loving kindness for yourself versus others? I know for me, it's often harder to practice metta when it comes to myself. I find it much easier to practice loving kindness and to recite those, you know, like, may you be happy, may you be healthy, when it comes to others. But for me, it's a different story. So for some of you here, do you find it easier to practice loving kindness with yourself, others, or do you find it hard for both? Lily, please.
Hi. I noticed that at the beginning, when I first started with metta, I always left myself out of the whole process because I felt that it was more important to generate that feeling for everybody else except me, until I noticed that something was missing and a knowledgeable person explained to me, you know, that you have to start with yourself. And it was hard. It was hard to really take that time because it felt like it's not worth it, which is a very, very strong statement, right? So it was hard, but then after a while, it softened. And this softening feeling turned into, you know, joy and a lot of tears as well. So afterwards, it came to me a lot easier. And also, I opened up to really express or do metta for everybody, like for the whole being, you know, for all beings in the world. So it was a very interesting process. Thank you.
Yeah, and that is very interesting for you to mention how, you know, after you had opened yourself up to receive metta from yourself, it sounds much easier to then extend it out to others. Like it kind of transformed the practice for you when you were able to receive that loving kindness for yourself. And I would say that very much resonates even with my own experience. I went on like a one-day retreat a while back, and we did a loving kindness meditation at some point. And I recall such difficulty in practicing loving kindness with myself. I remember I just started to cry, and it was like a bittersweet sadness. I remember because it was like, you know, confronting myself with this realization of how hard it is to just be kind to myself and to offer kindness to myself. But it was important to have that realization because it showed that I clearly had some work to do when it came to receiving and being willing to receive loving kindness. And I remember the topic of that retreat was generosity. And I think what struck me a lot about that topic was that, you know, you normally think of generosity as giving, but generosity is also about receiving. So this idea about, you know, allowing ourselves to receive loving kindness is not something that we typically think about when it comes to generosity or, you know, just kindness in general. We often are much kinder to others than we are to ourselves. And so I find a lot of the times that it is easier to practice metta and offer to others, but there is more difficulty when it comes to ourselves. Any other comments or experiences when it comes to loving kindness that someone might want to share? Yeah, Steve.
Hey, Alan.
Hey.
I find that frequently I'm pretty noisy just from whatever is happening in a day, and if I go into sitting that way, I'm generally not very successful with it because it's just too much thought. But as a prerequisite or just a preparatory step, I find that, you know, if I just take a little while just to do the loving kindness practice first, I calm down and have a much better sit.
That's wonderful. So you have found a way to like facilitate your sitting practice more easily by allowing yourself to practice loving kindness beforehand when it feels a little bit noisy.
Yes, exactly. It just you know, calms things down, and it becomes easier to concentrate at that point.
That's really insightful, and I'm wondering, you know, how helpful that might be to other people here who sometimes might struggle with that, because I know we all, you know, struggle with noisiness, and maintaining practice can sometimes be one of the hardest things to do. So as a tip, yeah, Peter.
In terms of noisiness, when I go for walks, one of the things that I enjoy doing is repeating loving kindness, kind of brief loving kindness, either focused on myself or using the words we, and using that to take up space that would otherwise be involved in some kind of commentary, imagining, planning, worrying, so forth and so on. I just fill up the space in my mind with repeating the mantra while I'm walking.
So it helps with you, with your noisiness as well, mm-hmm. and you incorporate walks as well. Mm-hmm. Look at that. We're getting a whole bunch of useful tips when it comes to sitting meditation, you guys. This is awesome. Yes, John. Oh, you're muted, John.
Now?
There we are.
Okay. I think the whole meditation process, I think loving kindness is my favorite words, is because I think it all, the whole process reminds, has to remind you that, and remind everyone, that we think in thoughts. We think in words. So then each word has a little pigeonhole. So you're sitting there having this little battle in the traffic jam. Mindfulness. Loving kindness. You know what I mean? So the point of the process is go back to breath. It's a non-thinking place. You can carry it with you. It's all a habit pattern, because we're just all habit dog, basically. And for example, if you love ice cream, you know what I mean? Well, you can only eat so much ice cream and then you're full. So the point is that I sit, and I hope everybody else sits, out of love for myself and love for everyone else, because it teaches me to be stronger in my awareness of what my brain's doing, because it's what's controlling the show. And it's just kind of like a catch-22. It's really cool how somebody 2,500 years ago, I mean, 500 years before Buddha, was this guy who wrote the Bhagavad Gita, you know, and he was doing transcendental meditation, watching the breath. But it's I mean, a metta, a mantra. And it's just really cool how, you know, the whole humankind seems to spend time thinking about the words that they think when go back to breath. Sit every day, because it is a chore, because you get spoiled by all those thoughts and you don't want to quit thinking. And you make yourself go to breath, you got to kind of have a fight. And I think it's hilarious and wonderful that we're being aware of it, because that's what it's all about. Thank you.
Yeah. And so what I'm hearing is that practicing metta ultimately strengthens your practice and makes you stronger, not only within yourself, but also for others as well.
You know, being aware, stronger in awareness of how this little mind is wanting to control it all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, when it comes to practice, and because there are, you know, struggles that come up with practice, it reminds me of the saying, you attract more bees with honey than you do with vinegar. So to offer yourself some loving kindness may, and as you're saying, John, even it could help to pull you away from distractions more effectively and help for you to cultivate your awareness. So we are much more inclined to cultivate that steady sense of awareness and that steady state of mindfulness if we practice loving kindness with ourselves. So it's going to be much easier to be kind to ourselves in our practice than it is to try to be harsh on ourselves and tell ourselves, like, we need to sit down, we need to practice, or else. So that's it. That is a very good point, John.
Sharon has something to add.
Yes.
I'm thinking about how integrated the teachings are when looking at ill will and loving kindness. And what I'm thinking about is the concept, what goes through my thinking when I'm feeling ill will arising, and I'll talk about that as an example of that, but and very recent example and a recurring one. When the sense of ill will begins to arise, what I tend to do is think about interbeing and how we are all connected. So when the ill will arises, it reminds me that everything's connected and everybody's connected. So it's important to temper the ill will. It's sort of like diluting ill will for me with loving kindness, recognizing that whatever ill will arises in me does affect me in a negative way. So it's important to kind of dilute it with loving kindness, if that makes sense. And the example I was going to use is I had been a victim of crime more than 3 years ago that was not getting, as a victim, I was not getting justice. And the person that stole my property kept evading the law. And just this week, I was supposed to get restitution this past week, and there is none. So the thought came through my mind, well, he got away with, you know, crime. And where's the justice? And I could go to the ill will part, but I really don't want to, because then it's sort of like a second arrow for me coming back and harming me, if that makes sense. That's kind of how the whole process connects for me.
Yeah. You're getting angry. It's not going to make your life any easier.
Well, and it doesn't get the restitution either.
Right.
So that's kind of my take on ill will and loving kindness.
Yeah, so what I'm hearing you say is that by focusing on interbeing, which has this kind of air or component of loving kindness, it helps to eradicate that ill will. So, and that is a good point to mention, the connection between interbeing and loving kindness, because when we think about how we're all interconnected, interdependent, it kind of brings up this question of, well, why would I want to wish any kind of ill will on that which I'm a part of or connected to? So that is a good point. And to your example, it does remind me of that quote, that Buddhist quote, that's like, you know, anger is like holding on to a hot coal and expecting the other person to get burned. So the same can be said for ill will.
I also wonder, somebody like that, what it must be like to live inside their body.
Yeah.
You know, how miserable or anxious or angry or whatever, or dominated by greed that person is. Exactly. That's pretty awful.
Exactly. That's what I meant. Yeah. He's already suffering.
And that then, when you think of it that way, it elicits compassion. Mm-hmm. On some level, which is a good segue, I think, into the next point of harmlessness. So moving on to the third and final intention, harmlessness is thought to be guided by compassion, or karuna, which is an opposition to cruel, violent, and aggressive thoughts. So whereas loving kindness has the characteristic of wishing for the happiness and welfare of others, compassion has the characteristic of wishing that others be free from suffering, a wish that is extended without limits to all living beings. So the key to developing harmlessness within right intention is to cultivate compassion for yourself and others to be free of suffering. And it also helps to contemplate on your own suffering, your own wish to be free from suffering, and then to then consider how others share that same wish. I know that we all struggle in some way, shape, or form. And I know that we all desire to not struggle in whatever forms that shows up. And so to be able to see ourselves suffering and to offer ourselves that karuna and compassion because we know we wouldn't want to be struggling with whatever we're struggling, does help to cultivate self-compassion And then likewise, we can understand that everyone else struggles in some kind of way, and they, just as much as we do, wish to be free of that suffering. So to notice your own suffering, to offer yourself self-compassion, helps to then notice the suffering in others and offer compassion to others. And this came up in you know, in a personal example as well. I think similar to what Peter was saying, I was reflecting on a person that I was holding a lot of resentment towards, ill will, right? We're learning. I was holding on to a resentment that they had done, but then it got me really thinking about, you know, how their internal experience must be like for them to have done what they did. And when I really, really got to empathize with them in that moment and consider their own internal experience for having been able to do what it was that they did, I remember feeling this authentic feeling of compassion. And I don't think that I had experienced it on that level before, but it was just a very authentic moment when you really just try and empathize with another person, especially somebody who's done you wrong, and you realize, like, oh my goodness, you must be, you know, really struggling if you were capable of doing such a thing. And so from that place of empathy comes the sincere hope that their suffering be relieved, because more suffering, or to wish more suffering, is not going to, you know, do any good. The less suffering there is in the world, the more it benefits everybody, based on that idea of inner being. So, you know, compassion is really important within Buddhism in general. And you know, I was wondering if anybody did have any personal examples, like similar personal examples related to compassion that they wanted to share. If not, it's okay, we can keep going, but I know that compassion or karuna is something like that, similar to metta, is something that we can struggle with as well. And often, whether it be difficulty with self-compassion or being compassionate towards others, especially those that have done us wrong. Are there any examples of compassion, perhaps within the recent past? Yeah, John.
I just wanted to share a tool that I use, that I wanted to share with the Sangha here, that maybe you already do it and don't think about it, but, and especially with compassion, it, you know, I practice carrying the breath when I'm going through my day. I'm aware of my breath. Now, I can do this at the same time that I'm thinking. So that is my tool that I develop when I sit, is to try to be simultaneous. And that is very helpful in getting to a calmer place for the mind. I call it no-think. You know, jhana is what it's called. It doesn't really matter. It's how you get there. But the point is consistently sitting. But the tool that I've ended up with is that I'm able to carry my breath through the day, through thinking, through, and it's a very handy way to keep ahead or keep in balance with this giant 60,000 thought a day animal between my ears. Thought I'd share that.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that, John. That sounds like, it sounds like it's quite helpful for you, and it's great to provide those kinds of tools to the rest of the people here. Any examples, either tips similar to John, or any kind of recent example where you've practiced compassion, either for yourself or another person? Yeah, Lily.
I wanted to give a quick example, which I feel might be helpful. I had the experience with criticism, and I feel this is, you know, it was so helpful, and it is helpful on a day-to-day basis, right? When you feel that somebody criticizes you or criticizes what you did, rather than going into the state of trying to defend your ego or trying to defend your action. You're really just, I was able to get into that situation of, wow, it must be so hard for you. Like, you must have had such a hurting, you know, painful experience in your past that you say something like this, right? And not being aware of it. So there was a difference between, it was compassion and not pity, because that was a very important distinction, right? So I feel that on a day-to-day basis, it would be so helpful to, you know, get to that moment when you're aware of, you know, anger is arising or resentment is arising, and just really look at that person and like, you must have been through something in order to really want to do something. It's a little bit, might be similar to your experience, but I felt that the distinction between pity and compassion was so important to not get into that revenge mode. Mm-hmm. So I thought that might be helpful.
That is huge. Yeah. Yes, Peter.
I find myself being much more a feeling of interest in watching lizards survive or other little critters survive, that they're so intensely alive and wanting to stay alive. And somehow or other, I just feel this tenderness when I see that. These simple little critters that their brains are, you know, the size of a grain of rice, and yet they're so alive and so, it's so rich, their aliveness. And so I feel a lot of tenderness toward that, and I think that's part of ahimsa, of nonviolence, is that appreciation that, you know, all life has this quality of some kind of joyful energy.
Yes, joy.
Compassion, and sometimes we don't know how to start as far as what is compassion. And it's small things like what Peter said. And one of the things that I do, and I didn't realize I was even doing it for a while, was that when the sanitation guys come and lift the garbage cans and take the recycling away, it's good to be thinking about what it is from their side. And I turn the garbage can so the handle is where they can grab it easily. And it's always turned back in this direction when I finish. And with the recycling bins, it's not much more trouble to keep them inside until the rain stops. Otherwise, it increases the load immensely. And it's just these little small things that add up and help others to understand that same compassion in small ways.
I have another.
Yeah.
For over 30 years, Paula has, when we go for walks on a daily basis, she carries a bag with her and picks up all the recyclables that she can find. And to me, that's nonviolence about the environment. It's harmlessness about the environment. And I think it's important for us to really keep that in mind, that this whole notion of harmlessness, you know, you might think, well, what harm does it do to have cans or plastics laying around? But then you read about all the microplastics that are in the environment and how that's, you know, in the fish and in the birds and in our bodies. So that to me is another aspect of kindness and non-violence, non-harming, that we often don't think about, but I think is really important, is environmental concerns.
Yes, These are all really great examples of just small ways that we can practice harmlessness and compassion, like with the example that Joy gave, that with the examples that Peter gave. And even within myself, I know, Peter, you were talking about like this tenderness towards lizards. I similarly strive to not kill any bugs that I find in my home, which is hard for me because I'm the kind of person to, you know, very cartoonish, like stand up on my table and start, like, you know, dancing mildly on top of it because I'm afraid that I saw like the smallest spider that probably won't do anything. But
so I invite you to not scratch that itch that makes you want to jump on the table and contemplate the beauty. Cockroaches are beautiful. If you look at them very carefully, same with spiders, they are beautiful creatures. But, you know, once you realize that, then it's much easier to not freak out.
I'm going to have to really sit with that one. Cockroaches are beautiful. Because, you know, it is, I know you're right. I know you are. So I just have to practice some loving kindness towards myself, I think, next time I encounter a cockroach, because I know you're right. But despite, yeah, Joy.
Now that we have a cockroach and a lizard, when I lived in Miami, every cockroach had a lizard that was looking for that. They were very territorial, and the lizard knew where that guy hung out. So the cockroaches there were there, you know, so they could clean, the lizards could clean up and eat the excess. So it's all in balance if we just take time to look at it and not spray it.
Yeah. Interbeing. And so, right, so despite how hard it is sometimes for me to not grab the spray, I do, every time that I can, I will grab a cup and place it over whatever bug and then, you know, do that whole maneuver where you put a little piece of paper under and then I'll open my door and I'll just let it out.
You know, you can buy devices that will do that.
I might invest in that because sometimes, you know, a cup is not readily available and there's this fear of running to the kitchen and then maybe it runs away, you know, and then what happens? Now I'm in fear for the rest of the night, but I shouldn't be, but you know. So yeah, like small things like that, like it doesn't take much effort to just grab whatever, you know, animal might have been in your house to just simply let them outside, even if it could be, you know, if the urge is there out of fear to want to kill it, to have a harmless attitude toward it and to simply let it outside, is acting within harmlessness. And I think, you know, I really want to emphasize the point that Lily made because I thought it was just so important, that distinction between pity and compassion, where we can very kind of insidiously go from thinking that we're being compassionate to we're actually acting out of pity, and that is harmfulness. So that would be the opposite intention for harmlessness. So so keeping that distinction in mind when we are practicing harmlessness, when we are, and you know, it can be very insidious, where it really is all about the attitude and intention. Because if I were to, say, take a spider out of pity and, you know, take it outside, I'm still performing the same act. But if in one scenario I'm acting from an attitude of pity, like I really pity this spider, then I'm not really acting out of harmlessness. I'm acting from harmfulness, even if, you know, the result is still the same. So keeping in mind within your attitude that distinction between compassion and pity, I think is just so important. Any other comments before we wrap up? Okay. So my last kind of final thoughts on this is to, well, first to kind of wrap up and summarize, you know, we covered right intention today, and the three components of right intention, renunciation, harmlessness, what was the second one? Goodwill. There we are. Renunciation, goodwill, and harmlessness are the three kind of sub intentions that we really want to be mindful of when it comes to right intention, and keeping in mind that for goodwill, renunciation, using mindfulness, body breath awareness, so that we can reinforce renunciation, practicing loving kindness, so that we can oppose ill will and so that we can live in alignment with goodwill, and practicing compassion or karuna so that we can help to cultivate harmlessness. Those are kind of like the main points that I really want to highlight. And when it comes to like our selfing process, because I know that we all engage in some kind of selfing, I was thinking about this the other day, how we're constantly living in our own stories. Like, we have a story for everything. We're either living in some elaborate story about something that happened, or we're simply just narrating our story as it's happening. Like, oh, I'm kind of hungry. What do I want to eat? I'm going to do this, or I'm going to do that. We're just constantly inundating ourselves with some kind of story. And the stories that we tell ourselves have immense power over how we end up thinking, how we feel, and how we act. But our stories are an illusion. They are ephemeral, they're self-constructed, and they don't hold any substance. And despite that, they really still end up dictating so much of our life experience. So right intention within this context asks that we let go of our stories and we allow our thoughts to be guided instead by these values or these intentions of renunciation, goodwill, and harmlessness. So having those really be what we end up directing our attention toward, as opposed to whatever stories we have going on, bringing our thoughts back to those main intentions is what is going to ultimately lead to less suffering. So I just wanted to leave you with that little piece. Any last minute questions or comments before we wrap up for today?
Well, let me say that you just provided me with a great intro into the topic for next week. I'll be talking about right speech, which is about the stories we tell ourselves.
There we go. So it was quite a synchronous way to end it, and I'm glad that we did end it that way.
Yes. So I will guide us in a brief closing meditation.
Sure.
Thank you for your practice. Wish you well and hope we're all reasonably safe and happy till the next time we have a chance to meet. And thank you for your excellent Dharma teaching tonight, Allie.